Senator Murkowski supports a woman's right to make her own reproductive choices. However, that support is not without limits.
A missed vote highlights Senator Murkowski's unusual place in the abortion debate. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, paleontologists unearth a new species of plant-eating dinosaur in interior Alaska.
And it was, of course, a warmer world, but they still had to contend with extensive periods of darkness because they were so far north.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
In Congress, a bill to ban abortion after the 20th week of pregnancy has failed to advance in the Senate. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who has angered both sides of the abortion debate in the past, did not vote on today's bill. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
As her spokeswoman Karina Peterson explains it, Murkowski did not intentionally duck the abortion vote.
The senator missed the vote this morning because she had prior travel commitments. She had reviewed the Senate calendar earlier this year and made travel plans based on the timing of the Jewish holidays and the fact that the Senate has historically not been in session around those holidays.
But this year, the eve of Yom Kippur coincides with the arrival of Pope Francis in Washington, and the Senate's Republican leadership scheduled a vote on the abortion bill for the same day. Only 54 senators voted to advance the midterm abortion ban. That's six short of the number needed to proceed. According to a statement Murkowski's spokeswoman read after the vote, her presence would not have put sponsors of the bill any closer.
Senator Murkowski supports a woman's right to make her own reproductive choices. However, that support is not without limits. She opposes late-term abortion and supports restricting abortion after 20 weeks, so long as there are clear and workable exceptions, such as for victims of rape and incest and in cases where the life of the mother is threatened. While she does not support the bill that the Senate failed to advance today, she could support future legislation that meets this standard.
Senator Dan Sullivan did vote for the ban, as did Congressman Don Young when the bill passed the House in May. But Murkowski, who is up for re-election next year, does not fit neatly into either side of the abortion debate. Last month, supporters of abortion rights were furious when she voted to proceed on a bill that would have defunded Planned Parenthood. Murkowski says she hoped to amend the bill to just defund affiliates if any are found to have broken laws against the sale of fetal parts. Now, the anti-abortion side is unhappy with her, too.
We are very disappointed and incredibly, her position, she's clearly confused about this legislation and its popularity among her constituents.
That's Mallory Quigley, communications director for the Susan B. Anthony List. The anti-abortion group ran web ads over the summer asking Murkowski to support the 20-week ban. The Alaska Democratic Party, meanwhile, put out a press release after the vote saying Murkowski caved in to right-wing interests. So, where was Murkowski traveling to or from that caused her to miss the vote?
I don't have that information to share. Sorry.
That's Peterson again, the senator's spokeswoman.
The senator has things on her schedule that are listed as private. I know, and I'm privy to the information that is official office travel or official office appearances. If she's having dinner with her husband, I wouldn't have that information.
Ditto, Peterson says, for fundraising events. She says Murkowski returns to Washington Wednesday night in time for the Pope's address to Congress on Thursday. And it appears in time for another procedural vote on defunding Planned Parenthood, this one linked to averting a government shutdown. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A new dinosaur species has been discovered in Alaska. Bones of the plant-eating hadrosaur were excavated by researchers working in a known fossil-rich zone north of the Brooks Range. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The newly identified dinosaur is the northernmost of three so far unearthed by a team working along the Colville River, a tundra area. University of Alaska Museum of the North Earth Sciences curator Pat Druckenmiller says was very different when dinosaurs roamed the region.
Imagine it when it actually was forested. And they were also living in a very strange world because that part of Alaska at that time, about 70 million years ago, it was actually farther north than it is today. So these are dinosaurs that lived in a polar environment, as much as 80 degrees north latitude. And it was, of course, a warmer world, but they still had to contend with extensive periods of darkness because they were so far north.
That sounds challenging for the new plant eater named Ugrunaluk kukpikensis, Inupiaq for ancient grazer. Druckenmiller says the herbivore prospered in less than ideal conditions, including ice and snow, using hundreds of teeth to munch conifer needles and other rough browse off the ground during the winter.
So in some ways, this new dinosaur is a bit like a moose in that it could subsist on poor quality forage in the winter months when it was a little harder to get by.
Druckenmiller says the new dinosaur grew to between 25 and 30 feet long and 7 feet tall at the shoulder and typically stood on its rear legs.
Interestingly enough, the majority of the bones we found were from not an adult size, but a juvenile size class that was only about 9 feet long and about 3 feet tall at the hips. And in fact, very soon we're going to be putting up at the museum a couple of mounted skeletons from the juvenile size class so that you can actually see what this animal looked like a little bit in better detail.
An artist rendering of the new dinosaur is already on display at the museum. Druckenmiller and fellow researchers, University of Alaska Fairbanks graduate student Hirotsugo Mori and Gregory Erickson of Florida State University, published their findings this week. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Researchers in Alaska have found the earliest known evidence that Ice Age humans in North America used salmon as a food source. A new paper published on Monday in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences asserts that chum salmon have been harvested in Alaska for 11,000 years. The findings are based on analysis of 11,500-year-old chum salmon bones found by University of Alaska Fairbanks anthropologist Ben Potter and colleagues at the Upward Sun River archaeology site in interior Alaska.
So they're just like modern salmon. They spend part of their life in the sea and they spawn in freshwater streams. So one of the, implications of this is quite surprising. We really had no evidence that people were doing this or that salmon were even there.
The ancient chum salmon migrated upriver near where the mouth of the Yukon River now exists. These analyses indicate that modern salmon migrations may have ancient roots. The findings also suggest that salmon spawning runs were established much earlier and much farther north than previously thought. UAF anthropologist Corinne Halfman helped analyze the bones.
This is the tail end of the Ice Age, so this provides direct evidence for the first time of humans capturing salmon this early, and that salmon indeed were available in interior Alaska.
The Upward Sun site is located between Delta Junction and Fairbanks. The salmon were found in an ancient cooking hearth in a residential structure. Fish remains pose a challenge to archaeologists because their bones are very small and fragile and typically do not preserve well. Because of these challenges, their remains are likely underrepresented in global archaeological studies and findings. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a task force looks into the complicated question of what caused the deadly Sitka landslide.
Knowledge is some kind of power, so if we can get more information about the area, we'll feel a little bit more at ease.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence,
and by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
Alaska's massive natural gas pipeline project is tiptoeing forward. Governor Bill Walker said that he plans to call a special session of the legislature this fall to discuss the project, dubbed Alaska LNG. That's a turnaround from just a few weeks ago. Earlier this month, Walker told reporters that disagreements between the state and its industry partners might not be bridged in time to bring the project before lawmakers. The proposed pipeline would carry natural gas 800 miles from the North Slope to Nikiski, with an estimated price tag hovering around $55 billion. The state is currently partnering with the companies ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, as well as pipeline builder TransCanada, although the governor would like to buy out TransCanada's share. Lawmakers and the governor are still working to pin down the exact date and location of the session. A formal announcement is expected later this week. Akiak resident Mike Williams Sr. watched approximately 50 feet of his land erode into the Kuskokwim River in less than 2 hours on Saturday. KYUK's Lakedra Chavis has the story.
Just as it was getting dark Saturday evening, Akiak resident and dog musher Mike Williams stepped outside to see his dog lot falling into the Kuskokwim River and seven of his sled dogs being pulled into the water.
They were beginning to be choked. But they're alive. They're okay now. They got them in just in time.
Williams says the dogs were hanging by their chains, their bodies dangling over the eroding banks.
We had to pull them out. They were in their chains and they pulled them out.
Williams' son-in-law went outside to check on Williams' 60 sled dogs when he realized something wasn't right. The lot was eroding into the riverbank, and quickly.
This is about the most I've seen in recent times in Akiak.
Williams was able to rescue and relocate all of his sled dogs, but he lost a refrigerator that stored dog food. What Williams experienced is called mass erosion.
These are tough times for all of us, and hopefully that a lot of erosion projects will be funded to help prevent all of this stuff.
Areas along the Kuskokwim are no stranger to erosion, especially in the era of Alaska's climate change. But in Akiak, erosion commonly occurs during breakup season when the river flows faster, not in late September. Chris Mao, an assistant professor of geology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, studies coastal geography and says Saturday's erosion is abnormal.
45, 55 feet in a couple hours is certainly, you know, a really dramatic rate of erosion.
Mal says that high rate is a result of three elements: the river's natural composition, warmer weather, and high rainfall.
I certainly think that that is an extreme, you know, what I would categorize as an extreme erosional event.
The sediment in communities along the Kuskokwim is composed primarily of silt, a fine gradient. And it's held together by permafrost. When the temperatures rise, the permafrost melts, weakening the riverbanks. When a heavy rain comes, it can tear the land away. William says it had been raining a lot before the mass erosion, raising the river. But he says the weather Saturday night wasn't particularly windy or intense. In 2009, the U.S. Corps of Engineers conducted an erosion assessment of almost 200 Alaskan communities. According to the assessment, Akiak is losing about an acre of land a year, and the village's communications hub will be lost within 30 years to erosion. Researchers conclude that the potential damages could cost more than $18 million. Akiak City Administrator Ivan Ivan says the city has developed a mitigation plan and recently applied for a disaster relief grant through FEMA. If awarded, the grant will help relocate about 9 homes close to the river. But, he says, they're still waiting to hear back. In Bethel, I'm Lakedra Chavis.
A little more than a month after a deadly landslide struck in Sitka, a group of scientists and agency officials are starting the complicated task of learning what happened. The GeoTask Force has been meeting at the Sitka Sound Science Center. The center's director, Lisa Bush, says the gatherings are an important step in understanding the area's geophysical hazards. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The most troubling aspect of the August 18th slide in Sitka is that it seems so random. Sure, it was raining hard, but it often rains hard here. What exactly made this day different than thousands of other days? What made a single address on Kramer Avenue so hazardous? The answer is literally a puzzle, and everyone's holding a different piece.
It's the Forest Service, it's the USGS, it's the National Weather Service, it's University of Alaska Southeast, University of Alaska Fairbanks, NASA, the National Park Service, the City of Sitka, Sitka Conservation Society, the Alaska State Department of Natural Resources Division of Geologic Survey. Who am I forgetting?
Sitka Sound Science Center Director Lisa Bush says the Geo Task Force began with a phone call to the Geophysical Institute in Fairbanks and took off from there. The Geo Task Force is a long way from providing any answers. Right now, they're working on framing the question.
So we got these groups together, and the idea has been to try and figure out what we know and what needs to be known.
So what is it that we know? Bush says there was a geophysical study of the area prior to the slide and some additional work in the aftermath, but the information is pretty basic.
So we know that it was 12 acres. We know the slide was about 1,000 feet. There have been several different flights around the slide area and up to West Chichikov. The National Weather Service says that this was a 50 to 75 year rainfall event that happened during high winds. We don't know yet exactly how it happened. So we don't know all of that information that to say what exactly the cause is yet.
The Geo Task Force has some exceptional tools at its disposal. A private satellite company took high-resolution imagery of the slide area. Bush says the National Park Service is working on acquiring that data. The State Division of Geophysical Survey has produced 3D ortho imagery of the slide that allows viewers to examine the slope in remarkable detail. And then there's just serendipity in the form of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
NASA was coming to Alaska anyway to try out a new technology, an experimental technology, AirMOS, in which they could measure the movement of the ground through the vegetation, and they could also measure moisture of the soil. And they were coming anyway to look at permafrost issues. And the timing of this was they basically said, hey, we're coming to Alaska anyway, we can change our flight plan and come and fly over Sitka. And so they've done that, and they've done that twice.
Bush says there's a chance that NASA will incorporate the Sitka landslide study into its Alaska AirMOS experiment. NASA is also funding a research collaboration between the National Weather Service and the University of Alaska Southeast on landslide predictability. Bush says the work so far has been a statistical correlation between rainfall events and slides and would produce forecasts for a general area rather than individual neighborhoods. It also doesn't factor in Southeast's complicated surface geology.
Most of us here in Southeast Alaska, we know that we have glacial till mixed with ash, mixed with a lot of rainfall. And that is a pretty brutal combination in terms of causing landslides.
Bush says that she's excited by the energy of the Geo Task Force. She believes the scientists and academics are driven by a strong desire to help the community learn as much as they can about the geophysical mechanisms behind these slides. What the Geo Task Force is not going to do is tell us where it's safe to live. Not yet.
There's a difference between risk assessment and knowing where the hazards are. And that's a whole nother set of people and different set of expertise. So sort of what we do with that hazard survey information is kind of the next question for policymakers to make.
Bush has lived in Sitka for a long time. She says she loves the mountains and the rainforest. The August 18th slide was a reminder that we live in this remarkable place at the mercy of forces beyond our control. For Sitkins looking for answers, Bush counsels patience and study.
To find some kind of understanding out of this tragedy. And I don't know if this is going to help us feel less powerless, but I guess we kind of think at the Science Center that knowledge is some kind of power. So if we can get more information about the area, we'll feel a little bit more at ease.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek, it makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska. Last Wednesday evening, a little after 5 p.m., an autistic 28-year-old Kodiak man walked down his quiet neighborhood street to check the mailbox, as he does most days. It's unclear what happened next, but as Jay Barrett from member station KMXT reports, when Nick Pletnikoff's mother found him, he was surrounded by three Kodiak police officers who had pinned him to the ground and pepper sprayed him.
In a very short statement faxed to media around quitting time Monday, the Kodiak Police Department defended the actions of the three officers, saying they were responding to a 911 call that someone was trying to steal something from a car parked along Stellar Avenue, the street Nick Pletnikoff grew up on. His mother, Judy Pletnikoff, demanded answers why her son had been assaulted, and the only thing she was told by police was that he refused to answer their questions.
And I said, he has autism. He would really struggle to answer your questions. He lives right there. And I saw they had his ID and they could see where he lived.
Nick Pletnikoff was not charged with any crime and was released to his mother. The KPD's official statement regarding the incident stated that the use of force against him was, quote, minimal and necessary under the circumstances in order to maintain officer and community safety. It did not elaborate what kind of threat Nick Pletnikoff was to them or the community, or why he was pepper sprayed while pinned to the ground by the three police officers. Judy Pletnikoff found her son handcuffed, bloodied, and bruised. And like any mother, she wanted to know what happened.
I didn't get any answers, and I asked probably three or four times who had their hands on his neck, but he'd been pepper sprayed, and he was crying, and he said, I'm so sorry.
Kodiak Chief of Police Rhonda Wallace was out of town last week, and her office only referred to the incident in its daily police blotter as, quote, suspicious circumstances, all okay. The event might have blown over without much notice, but an eyewitness posted a description of what he saw on a Kodiak-centric Facebook page, generating hundreds of angry comments. It prompted another local man, Brent Watkins, to stage a silent vigil in front of the police station on Friday. He held a sign that read, "Heroes don't beat up handicapped kids."
Oh, he's a heck of a kid. Always pleasant, always ready to say hi, greet you if he knows you. But he can't express himself really well. And that's where things went south.
Dissatisfied with a lack of response from the police department, the Pletnikoff family retained Kodiak defense attorney Josh Fitzgerald, who in conjunction with Angstman Law Office in Bethel are investigating the incident.
We think that, these three officers that had him down on the ground and then pepper sprayed him were likely not justified in doing that. We think that there aren't facts to support that kind of conduct. But we are waiting to see the video, which we understand has been preserved, and any sort of audio recordings and things that were at the scene. But we think that this young man did not deserve to be injured at all, and certainly not the way that he was.
Since they are public documents, KMXT has filed a Freedom of Information Act request for the audio and video recordings from the officers' body cams and recorders, as well as their squad car dash cams. As for her son's condition, Judy Pletnikoff says he's had trouble sleeping and now fears those in uniform.
You know, he hasn't slept a night through since then. He's afraid, definitely afraid of figures of authority, and particularly the police. He's definitely a changed client. But my biggest concern is how to get him back to his former considerate, reasonable, happy self.
She says the family has hired an autism specialist to work with her son and help him process what happened to him and help speed his emotional recovery. In Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett.
A hefty excise tax on wholesale tobacco products sold in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough is under scrutiny. At last week's meeting of the Borough Assembly, e-cigarette users spoke out against the new tax. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has the story.
The new ordinance went into effect when it was passed in August. It puts a 55% tax on wholesale purchases of e-cigarette products in the Matsu borough. That borough ordinance was followed by outcries from owners of fledgling vape shops. Those are the retailers providing the products used in e-cigarettes.
Putting them out of business, running them out of the city is not something that's going to help smoking. It's not something that's going to help the economy, and you'll actually lose the sales tax revenue that you're currently generating from these businesses.
That's e-cig smoker Mark Sowers. The tax is passed on to consumers through the retail price of the products. Matsu Borough Assemblyman Jim Sykes says there's good reason for the high tax.
The nicotine juices cost very little on wholesale, and the markup is pretty high. And so 55%, it's at 90% in Minnesota. So there's a lot of money being made here because that's why shops are opening like crazy all over the country.
Sykes says money from the tax goes into the borough's general fund and will be used for anti-smoking education, although the ordinance is not specific as to how the tax will be spent. Sykes says the high tax could help to sway young people from buying tobacco products. The legislation, however, has raised complaints from e-cigarette smokers and owners of vape shops. It also has ping-ponged from approval to mayoral veto to override and then back to the assembly, where it showed up on the agenda last week, waiting for an amendment that never materialized. At the meeting, Ashley Peltier applauded the assembly's action, saying that the ordinance's 55% tax should stand.
Presently, there is no government oversight of these products. Therefore, there is no way for public health and medical community or consumers to know exactly what chemicals are contained in or emitted from the devices, or what the short and long-term health implications may be.
But a greater number of smokers came out swinging at the meeting and claimed that vaping, or smoking e-cigarettes, has helped them stop smoking tobacco cigarettes. Many, like Mike McInnes, disputed the fact that vaping causes the same kind of damage that smoking tobacco does.
If anything should be taxed, it should be the nicotine. We should not be punishing people that are vaping at 0 milligram nicotine. We shouldn't be taxing the equipment itself, especially the batteries, which can be bought at all kinds of different places.
According to Assemblyman Sykes, the ordinance is copied from one now in effect in Juneau, only with a 10% higher tax rate. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Lakeed Rashavis in Bethel, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Jay Barrett in Kodiak. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Rural CAP commemorates 50 years of delivering early childhood education programs like Head Start and Parents as Teachers. Signature housing programs, including weatherization, self-help housing, and permanent affordable housing, make a difference in our communities. AmeriCorps members and elder mentors have positive impacts to education, health, and the environment. Learn more at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.